Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Chuck Jones.
Thank you. I am 82 years old, and which could happen to anybody. I mean, there'd be a lot of people are headed in that direction at any rate. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, you notice how I bring in all this culture. Oliver Wendell Holmes said that when he was a little older than I am, he said, somebody asked him how it felt to be an old man. He said, I don't feel like an old man. I feel like a young man that has something the matter with him. I said, and he said, some beautiful little chick went across the way, and he grabbed his friend by the arm and said, oh, to be 70 again. So you can see there's life in the ancient frame. A nice thing about being an animator is that, you can create. If you can't do it yourself, you can animate somebody who can, like Pepe Le Pew, for instance. It's just as well that we cut off what Pepe is doing off stage, because it's really disheartening to see how much he makes a shambles out of the Hayes office. A very sexy skunk.
I noticed that today the name Maurice Noble got some applause from a knowledgeable audience.
Yeah.
So I wanted to start by asking you about...
He's still there, obviously, and he came out of retirement long enough to do this film. Maurice came out. He's 87 or 83. Anyway, he's older than I am, by God. Not that it means much, you know, when you begin to add him after 82. It doesn't really matter a hell of a lot, I guess. And I remembered was that, again, off subject, but something that stuck in my mind was what John L. Lewis said about William Green. He was head of the mine workers, and Green was head of the AFL. And he said Green doesn't have a head. He said his neck just grew up and haired over. Because... So a frog doesn't have any hair, but that's what it looks like, you know. It looked like his body grew up and sort of slimed over, I guess. And so, but I felt we've got to get this frog to be very believable in a very short time. So when he pulls himself up out of the can, he slips a little bit. And when he blinks upward. The blink goes upward. Now, that may sound ridiculous that... who knows that? I know it. So I put it in, by God, and you better be impressed. The thing is, you have to do that kind of thing. I mean, you've got to believe it yourself. You have to believe the character. You've got to believe in Daffy Duck. You've got to believe in these characters. A live action director, an animation director, is very much like an actor. He moves from role to role. He does not, like a comic strip, he doesn't, whether the characters are not funny looking. My frog looks exactly, I hope, like a frog. Bugs Bunny looks like Bugs Bunny. He may not look like a rabbit, but he sure as hell looks like Bugs Bunny. He has an anatomy, and he moves like Bugs Bunny. In the same sense that Daffy has an anatomy, and he moves like Daffy. I have one. I can only move according to whatever dubious skeleton I have, and it's being replaced part by part. I have a new hip. I have part of an ankle. I have a pacemaker. I have an insatiable appetite for martinis. And, you know, in other words, I'm becoming more like the Tin Man. But, again, I can only move according to the structure that I'm in some time in my life I'm stuck with.
Many of your greatest cartoons are, in effect, pantomimes, that there's no dialogue. The Roadrunner series is basically a pantomime series. The Run Froggy Evening has no dialogue. I had a few questions about that. One is whether there was an influence from silent comedy, the films of Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, on your development.
Well, I when I was a kid about 7 or 8 years old, just after the First World War. My father had an orange grove on Sunset Boulevard opposite Hollywood High School, and he didn't see any future in films, but he saw a future in oranges. And so we had quite a large orange grove there. And as far as I was concerned, I didn't realize that I was different than other little boys, and I didn't realize that every little boy in the world couldn't go out and sit on his front steps to see Mary Pickford ride by on a white horse at the head of the 160th Infantry of the Rainbow Division of the First World War. I figured anybody could do that. And so it wasn't impressive to me. And it wasn't impressive, although it was extremely interesting to go down and watch Chaplin at work. It was two blocks from our house, and we could go down there and look through this fence and watch Chaplin shoot. But he was very disappointing to me because I'd seen his films, and to see him out there doing things over and over and over again, which I thought was ridiculous, because in his films he didn't do things over and over again. And so I didn't quite understand the concept. But my father told me one time he came home from over there. He did get into films in one way or another, but mostly the other. He said he saw Chaplin do one scene 132 times. And the thing is that it was a little thing where, you know, that little choppy run that all the comedians use where they hop on one leg when they went around a corner and be chased by cops. And this one called for him to do it in the ice, which he couldn't do in Southern California because there wasn't any ice. So what he did was put down a oilcloth and then oil it. So then he tried to do this thing, and of course his feet would slip out from under him. And it ran his father said it ran about 15 seconds. And he shot it 132 times before he had it right. Hmm. And that stuck with me, that idea of 132. I thought he was lying, but I didn't. My father did lie. I mean, after all, he promised my mother a genius and didn't deliver.
Meaning me.
And let me give you a very quick run-through on the way I work at Warner Brothers, because it was different than it was at Disney's. There were three units there. In the very early days, there were Tex Avery and Bob Clampett and me. And later, Fritz Freleng came over from MGM. So from 1946 on, when Clampett had long gone and Tex had gone to MGM, Bob McKimson and Fritz Freleng and I directed all the films from 1946 until they closed the studio in 1963. I don't know where they are, but I know when Tex was dying, and he knew he was in a hospital and with a friend, and he said, I don't know where animators go when they die, and they probably don't need another animator. But then he thought a minute, and he said, Fred, he said, I bet they can use a good director. He was a very gallant man and a very funny man, a very shy man, godly enough. And consider how raucous his stuff was, that he wouldn't think of him as being shy. But I find, at least my experience has been, that all great men are shy, and all great women are shy too. That there's and all of us are uncertain. I have that at least in common with greatness, and that is that I can't ever look at a finished anything I do with any confidence. I can only see there's mistakes. So whatever else that I may have, I don't know. That's for you to decide. I mean, your laughter decides it. However, you do these layouts and so on, first of all, you have to design the character. On live action, when the script is completed and the director says, fine, I want to make this film, then you have what they call a casting session, when they send in actors of all various kinds and the director or his whoever works with him will select the actor to play that part. Our equivalent of that was in what was to like with Pepe Le Pew. I knew that I wanted a sexy skunk, but I had never seen him. I knew what he would do, but I had to figure out. So my casting session then was to sit down and start drawing skunks, and they were terrible, as you saw here on the Coyote. The Coyote is a lot different today than he was then. He had a big, kind of long, spotty nose. So I had that session, but I didn't really. I improved him, but I certainly changed him over a period of time. Pepe changed a bit too, but you have to use him immediately, so your first casting session. So getting back, this doesn't usually work out, but getting back to that 132 times a Chaplin shot, we didn't do that. We could not do it. We could not shoot a scene over and over again. But I have, in an effort to find a single drawing, and I don't mean that this point is when I'm trying to find out what Pepe is. I must have made 500 drawings of Pepe before I got the character the way I wanted him. But I have, very often in a picture, drawn 50 times, 50 drawings of a character in a particular situation. You may remember, did you run Feed the Kitty?
Yeah,
we did. Well, you know that scene where he went, "Me?" You know, and she came and said, what are you up to now? And he said, "Me?" And he didn't say it. But I, God, it was hard to get that drawing right. And I worked on it, worked on it, worked on it. It didn't work, you know. I had never drawn a bulldog saying "me" without saying it. And looking, with that wonderful feeling of incredulity. I really like that picture. I really fell in love with that damn dog. And he was so touching. And when the lady said, "I know what's bothering you," she said, "Here," and she gives the dog that damn cookie. And the dog takes it and puts it in the back. And they cry. You know, I do. I really do. And I didn't intend it that way, by God. I thought I was being funny. And I found out I felt a true sense of sorrow about this little guy. And so, let me very quickly then. So having done those layouts, having timed every scene in the picture, and including how long the scenes were, physically long if the guy's running, so on, and then you call the animators in and go over the entire story with them, and then you hand out sections to each of the animators. They weren't specialists. I like animators to be able to do lots of things, and to try, you know, and I think that's where the fun is, the variety of it. And so then the animator takes it away and animates on it, and he has an assistant animator that follows him up, the guys who want to become animators. And in the meantime, Maurice Noble, I just give him the storyboard, which is very rough. Storyboard is not what's going to appear on the screen, because most guys that do the writers are not very good artists. So I just hand the idea to Maurice and say, while I'm doing the character drawings, I want you to plan the scenics, the back, act as the art director. And that's what they would do. So he would get it. He would be designing the film, the terms of the backgrounds, layouts, and so on, while I was doing the other thing. And then that pretty much takes care of the creativity. From that point on, it's ink and paint and donkey work, really, and the camera. But a cameraman doesn't, he has no volition. All he can do is what he's told to do. So when you give a cameraman an animation or an editor credits, you're not really being fair to anybody else, because it's all been done for him. All he does is put the background down, put the cell over, pull the thing down, push a button, and do it again. It is not artistic, but there are certain people who seem to like to do it, and it has kind of a wonderful routine to it. But you have to think about how slow he's moving, because that it takes him probably 2 hours to get 3 seconds done. So. You can't. It isn't very moving, even the Roadrunner. So that's really the way we worked at Warner Brothers. They didn't work that way at any other studio that I know of.
When is the soundtrack completed, or the relationship of the soundtrack to when you're doing the animation? Because you have a brilliant composer, Carl Stalling, and great sound effects people. So do they actually create the soundtrack and record it before the drawings?
Yeah, it varied. If you're doing What's Opera Doc, we would work with the music. And we took the storyboard, and then I'd make a bunch of kind of layout drawings, and Maurice would do some what we called inspirational sketches. Then we'd pull the musician in, and we'd go over the story. And like on What's Opera Doc, we took the entire Ring of the Nibelung, which runs 14 hours, and squashed it down to 6 minutes. But the music that was played was honest. I mean, that was really, each section was not squashed. It was just that we took out sections that we particularly liked, because it's le majeste to take that great music and do anything with it that is unfair. And I mean, the fact that when I went to Germany and visited his grave, I The fact that I can hear a whirring sound, I don't know. Wagner, that is. Mark Twain said that Wagner's music is better than it sounds. And I think if you listen to the whole 14 hours, you'd think so too. Yeah, he had fun with the German language, you know. He said that German language is the only language in the world that has perspective. The words have perspective. They're so long and go in the distance.
You worked with characters that had personalities, and you had to work with the personalities. And then you also created cartoons where, in the example of Dot and the Line or the High Note, where they had no even set personality. You know, where maybe you had to make a line move or a note walk. What was the difference, and which did you prefer?
As far as I'm concerned, the characters did have personality. But I didn't do it the same way. We were determined on Dot and the Line that we would keep, like Cezanne or Matisse, that we would keep everything on the surface. We were trying to avoid any depth or roundness, and we didn't use anything. But in that case, what I was looking for, and to a certain extent, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the personality of the narrator was so vital. And Robert Morley imbued into the Dot on the Line, he was able to shift over from character to character. But I was determined on that one because it was a little book, you see, and I didn't want to change the book by putting faces on it or anything like that. So, yeah, it was different. There's no question about it. It's a different way of approaching. The question has to do with favorites, like with Norton Juster, who wrote The Dot on the Line, and Dr. Seuss, of course. I don't have favorites of anything. You know, it's like having, if you have four or five children, you're going to have a favorite, but you better keep it to yourself. Because it really is really a problem. And you owe every character that you work with the very best that you have. I haven't always able to do so, but my intent always is that Daffy Duck deserves as much of my attention as does Bugs Bunny or Dr. Seuss or anybody else. You owe any audience the best that you can do. That may sound rather, you know, noble, but it's also practical. And so you don't ever have to worry about it. You say, I can kiss this one off. You can't. If you ever think you can approach any subject by saying, I can do it, this snap, that hurts. It hurts the audience. It hurts you worse than anything. So you have to approach everyone with great intensity. And that's why when we do What's Opera, Doc, for instance, the music is played by an 80-piece orchestra, and it's played correctly. It's played the way it should be played. But the fact that Bugs Bunny and Elmer are in front of it, and I always felt that they are trying to do it right. And Maurice talked to me, and he said, you know, we have a real problem on this picture, because he said, we want this to feel like the classic ballet, and yet he said, we don't have any flesh tones, and we don't have the tutus, you know, that sort of thing. So he said, I said, well, think about it, see if you can come up with an idea. I'll do anything, you know, because we talked this back and forth. He said, well, and he came back later, and he said, why don't I paint the background in flesh tones and the trees like tutus, which he did. And if you look at it, you'll see that during that whole sequence, it's all flesh-toned backgrounds. And so it's, you're left subliminally, you know. I talked it over with Sigmund Freud, and he agreed, you know. And so so you do look for things like that. And that opening, which was a tribute, a very sweet tribute, we felt, to Night on Bald Mountain, because Bill Teitla, who animated that and also animated Stromboli, was our Michelangelo, you know, powerful, beautiful, strong stuff. So Abe Levito animated that. He also had this remarkable, powerful way of drawing, and I loved laying that out, the shadows and so on. So yeah, that's I don't know, you probably don't realize how cultural we were. I know you don't.
Whose idea was it to use Boris Karloff
Je. Okay. Moi. Because, you see, Boris Karloff or the Grinch. You know, Fred, Dr. Seuss, Ted Geisel, did not know anything about Karloff. He knew that he played all those parts, as everybody did. And that he played the monsters and so on. But many people had never known that he, and you probably can still get the records or a disc today of him telling the Just So stories and the Kipling book and all that stuff. And I'd heard it, I'd read it. And what was curious, of course, was that when we did the Jungle Book, I haven't seen the new one, but I mean, when we did Rikki Tikki Tavi and the White Seal was from the Jungle Book, curiously enough, I didn't think Disney took the trouble to find out how to pronounce the boy's name, Mowgli. And in recordings made in the 1930s and 40s, Karloff called it Mowgli. And my father, when I was 6 years old, called it Mowgli. Well, Kipling's daughter was still alive. He was not. So I called her up on the telephone, and I said, I'm going to do Rikki Tikki Tavi on the screen for television. And I said, but there's one thing that puzzles me. I said, how do you pronounce Mowgli? And this wonderful old voice came out of there, like Edna May Oliver, and she said, you pronounce it Mowgli. She said, I hate Walter Disney. And that was the first time I ever heard him call Walter.
Okay, you said that you did a lot of the characters just for fun, but how did you decide what characters you wanted to go on and keep doing?
There's not a day in my life that I don't make 20 drawings. From the first time I started drawing till today, I can't get through a day because some people call them doodles, but they're not. They're just drawings. The decision about, I don't know how you do anything. I don't know why you decide to do anything. You know, you go into a restaurant and you open the menu and you say, the lamb chops look good. How the hell do you know that here? They're in the kitchen. They look good, you know, they look good. There's no carrots look good. Ridiculous. I don't know how I pick out a character, but it's a good question. I just wish I had a rational answer, but I don't have it. It just comes a point where something seems to work. So you say, that looks like it's going to work, and you try it. But in animation, you also have to try it out to see whether it'll move right or not. I don't pay any attention to the audience. I don't see how you can. I used to watch the guys in the features, you know, and I don't know of any director who doesn't do this, and that is to take, if he takes the picture out to preview and he doesn't get what response he wants, he'll go to another theater until he finds out, you know, he'll find somebody that does like it. Which leads us again to the whole idea, what is the difference between tragedy? I mean, comedy is always concerned with simple matters. A coyote wants to catch a roadrunner. That's a simple matter. Well, something to eat. Charlie Chaplin's looking for some place to sit, get something to eat, to act well as a waiter, to hand a girl a rose. All these things are very simple. Comedy is built on that. And I think, obviously, that is why we are so much more devoted to comedy than we ever can be to grand tragedy. It's just too big. And giant tragedies don't happen to us all the time. And very, very seldom the gods came roaring down out of the heavens, you know.
Was Dr. Seuss involved in the Private Snafu cartoons? And a lot of his cartoons are now coming back, being re-released. Just what's your feeling about that?
Yeah, well, yes, of course. And Dr. Seuss did work at what they called Fort Western, which is Western Avenue and Sunset Boulevard. And Frank Capra was the colonel in charge there. Ted Geisel, that's Dr. Seuss, was the captain, and that was during the war, and a number of other people that we worked with, Dr. Seuss and several people, Otto England there, who had been Disney writer on Dumbo and other things, and a number of people that worked at Disney's worked with him, and they wrote the stories, and I directed about a half of them. Frizz did a few, and so the other guys directed a few of those. That's the only time I really knew what the audience was like. Most training films, as anybody's ever been in the Army, knows how bad most training films are. They're bad, and at that time they were terribly bad because they were made by Army people, let's put it this way. Animation was a very good way to do a training film because if you use live action, if you used soldiers trying to act, they couldn't act. And if you used actors pretending like they were soldiers, you would, only in Orange County where we live, do people not know the difference between a hero and some people who act as a hero. Ronald Reagan and John Wayne are considered heroes. And I think as actors, John Wayne was a marvelous guy, but he certainly was not a hero. Except, you know, like others, he was brave when he got cancer. But everybody in Orange County thinks he, you know, he won the war. It's a funny place to live. And actually, it's particularly funny now. I thought I can tell you because we don't think the way they do. And you know, after I really wouldn't vote for Genghis Khan if he came back to life. But they all would, you see. And we have to separate them. So it's a little... So when this scandal hit, Marion and I just went crazy. Wonderful, about time, my God. They're so pious. And Pope Pius. Anyway, well, contrary to common belief, Mel Blanc never brought us a voice. He was one of the most brilliant actors I've ever known, extraordinarily quick. He was able to transfer his personality when we told him, but every line was carefully crafted by the writer and by the director. I worked hard on the dialogue because I didn't want any fat in there. And a line written for Daffy could never have been delivered by Bugs. And a line for Pepe Le Pew was a special line written expressly for him. When the actor came in, he had never seen the storyboard. And Mel would come in about an hour before we were to record the film. I'd go over the storyboard with him, and then carefully, then if it was Bugs and Daffy, for instance, I would read Bugs's lines, and he would read Daffy, and then we'd reverse the situation, and I'd be Daffy, and he'd be Bugs. So that if Daffy was saying, "Let's run through that again," I'd say to him, then he'd play it back. "Let's run through that again." And he'd say, I'd say, "Okay." He'd say, "Shoot him now, shoot him now." And because of the time, now you have to see that it took us 5 weeks to do a 6-minute cartoon. So a lot of time was taken up in writing the dialogue and delivering it. Yes. When Warner Brothers decided in their foolish way, that they wanted to hire a man of my age to make some more cartoons, my condition was this, that I would not go in and make cartoons unless I could do it with young people. And that I wanted and felt it vital and necessary for Warner Brothers and to reconvene the idea of Termite Terrace, young people doing cartoons. The end purpose of my going to work for Warner Brothers was do away with me. I mean, in 3 years, I don't want to be there. I want the young people to have learned what is necessary to make cartoons, to make new adventures of old characters, and to come up with fresh characters and new adventures. And that's what they are. The people that animated this were all of them. I think the oldest one was maybe 32, and the youngest one was 19, which is pretty much the way it ran in our studio. As I said, when I went in the business, I was not quite 18, and the old man was Disney, and he was 29. Mm-hmm. It's hard to believe that Walt Disney was under 40 by the time he had finished Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and Fantasia. Mm-hmm. It was a young man's... Today it's a young person's game. So we have women and men. The musician we have is George Doherty. He's 35. and but he's a great student of Milt Franklin and Carl Stalling. Maurice came in long enough to help. This was all, the backgrounds were all painted and designed by young people, with Maurice hovering over them to help them. And then he went back into, not into retirement, because he went back to doing doing watercolors and stuff like that. So that was the whole point. Very kind of curious thing when you look at it objectively, that when I came into the business, there were a bunch of old men, and I use the term old men, running our business, and Leon Schlesinger and those guys were between, you know, 40s and early 50s. A bunch of old men running our business. Well, today, at 82, I look back and see there's a bunch of young men, 45 or 50, running the business. But the artists have to be, I want to hire people. And so they're trying to set up a feature unit over there, too, and hiring people like that for that purpose. But that's not our business. My business is short subjects, and I love it, and I enjoy it. I have a new book coming out. And of course, the Peter and the Wolf book is advertised in New York Times this week.
Chuck-a-muck 2 or
something like that. Hmm? Chuck-a-muck 2. Chuck-a-muck. Well, yeah. Well, no, it's Chuck-a-muck Redux. So it's spelled D-U-C-K. That's what we're doing. And so come here and hear you guys seeming to enjoy the things that we did. And hopefully enjoying the things of the future. I'm certainly grateful to you, because all the years we were making cartoons, we never, ever had any direct contact with an audience. And nobody ever wrote about us during those years. And the sad thing is that people like Tex Avery and Bob Clampett and those guys never lived long enough to get the recognition. It really started in France the same way that, you know, American jazz really got its first recognition in France, too. A wonderful book called Les Jazz Hot, which I thought was a perfect and a wonderful name.
Yeah.
So these guys started writing about American animation long ago. I mean, they started in the 1960s even. But it's a rebirth, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing my best to see to it that it happens. Well, I don't know that I serve as a midwife, but anyway, thank you so much for coming.
Okay.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.